Well, as we gather inside this morning, the skies outside, of course, are a bit hazy and ominous due to the ubiquity of the wildfires ravaging our state. And these fires, well, at least presently, not an immediate threat to us, are a grave reminder of the dangers of the fire season in California. And with that threat comes questions that I know that some of you in this room have actually had to answer in the past. The fire is coming, right? The authorities are calling for evacuations. What do you grab? You know, what is it that you take with you? What is important enough to pack up and to hold on to? I think most of us, hopefully all of us, would agree that packing up the family is a great place to start. Most would include their pets into this scenario, but I do know some of you who might just leave them to God's providential care during that time. But aside from the living things, what are you going to take with you? I mean, what are your prized possessions? I mean, the common answers to this question go as follows, right? You know, we grab family photos when people used to have photos, though now maybe we'd grab our computer or device that housed these photos. Maybe you grab your jewelry, or your important documents, you know, the will and the birth certificates and the stocks you may own. Maybe your family heirlooms or any items of significant sentimental value. And while for others, maybe less sentimental things. Maybe you grab the tools of your trade or your guns, whatever it may be. But what is it that's important? What's prized? I mean, heaven forbid you really love that new sectional couch you got, because that might be a rough go if trying to get out in a hurry. But these are the sorts of questions that are born out of crisis. And they can be helpful because they force us to consider what's important to us. But what is interesting is they also can be very, very misleading. Misleading because what they bring to the fore is that what we consider to be our prized possessions also hide what we actually consider to be our most prized possessions in the midst of the routine of the mundane realities of everyday life. So while most people would say, you know, I would grab my wife and kids, no matter their religious background or their spiritual state, if we look around our world, it's obvious that many do not use their time or energy in their family life with spouse and children in a way that signifies that they really hold them as dear or valuable. And so the crisis may provide an opportunity for one to refocus his priorities, but they also hide what we truly prize in the midst of non-crisis, when things are just normal. And of course, that is where most of life takes place. Most of life takes place in the day-to-day trenches filled with jobs and chores and traffic and tedium, passing conversations, eating and drinking, and then daydreaming about all the fun stuff. I mean, what do these days teach us about what we hold dear? What do the normal, mundane days teach us about what we actually value? Well, our text is asking those same questions, and it too is using a day of crisis to bring out some answers and then to challenge our altruistic assumptions about ourselves and about what we really believe about the value of the kingdom. I mean, just like the news has been showing us these, gloomy orange skyscapes of some, like, you know, apocalyptic Mad Max type scenario as we see over San Francisco and other places. So Luke gives us this apocalyptic picture, a scene that is full of doom and gloom in hopes that we will see the warning signs that he's holding up as he shows it. And he does hold up three stop signs that I want us to see this morning. One is stop looking for signs. Two, stop looking for things to get easier. And three, stop looking for a kingdom apart from the king. So let's begin where Luke begins. Stop looking for the signs of the times. Stop looking for signs. Our text begins with a conversation that we are interrupting, and it tells us a bit of the background. The Pharisees have just asked Jesus, when will the kingdom come? And of course, there is quite a bit of background built into that question that we can't fully cover this morning. But you have to see, they're asking nothing less than the question of, when will the promise of David's kingdom finally be realized on earth. All of those Old Testament prophecies, God, that you told us that David's son would restore a throne in Israel, and once that throne is restored, Israel would be restored to a place of preeminence in the world. We would no longer have Gentiles roaming our streets, and we would be honored and exalted in the world. When is that kingdom coming? And so they're asking the question that we might call in our day and age a question about the end times, or a question about what some churches refer to as the millennium, right? This day of David's reign on earth when Israel is exalted in the nations. And notice the assumption built into the question of the Pharisees. The assumption is that this is something that has not happened yet. It's coming in the future. So when is the coming of the kingdom? And the reason they believe it's a future event is because if it had already happened, they would have seen it. I mean, there's observable signs and proofs that this would have taken place. I mean, like many in our modern evangelical circles, the Pharisees look around and they see the current state of events, right? They see Gentiles in charge, you know, Romans walking their streets, the Roman Empire taking over the world, and grossly immoral Gentiles at that. They see the people of God in a state of weakness. They're unpopular. They're oppressed. They are set back as far as, you know, cultural prominence. They are low on the totem pole. And so that clearly can't be. God's kingdom clearly couldn't be in the world right now. So when is it that God's going to set up his kingdom and establish justice and freedom for his people? And while this may be hard for us to take, depending on your Christian background, Jesus immediately wants to disabuse them of their method of discovery, first of all. They, like so many Christians of our own day, thought that they could look around, observe signs. The word literally is, you know, study the stars. They thought that they could, you know, open up the Drudge Report and read the headlines, or turn on the news, or figure out what's going on politically and say, well, you know, if this is happening, then surely this is a sign that God's kingdom is close to being established on the earth. These are precursors of proof that that day is near. If you have been in any conversation with Christians these days, maybe you're hearing things like this. I mean, look at what's happening around us. And no, I have not been reading your Facebook page, so if this is you, I apologize ahead of time, but it's not because I knew. I mean, look at all the signs of the end times. I mean, just a few nights ago, the moon turned red, for Pete's sake. You know, the mountains around us are melting like wax. Political power players are wanting a one-world government with a single currency through a pandemic that will end with the implanting of microchips forced vaccines. And you can hear Jim Morrison slowly crooning in the background, you know, this is the end, my only friends, the end. This idea that if we can just keep up with the times, we will see that we can somehow figure out when God's kingdom is going to come and to be established. And of course, when all this comes to a conclusion, Jesus will then set up his kingdom. But Jesus rebukes that notion outright, doing his best Bob Newhart impression, saying, you know, stop it. Stop thinking that you can look for observable signs. Stop thinking that you know anything. The main proof that he wants to offer is that they've missed something altogether. So he says, stop looking for signs for two simple reasons. The kingdom does not come with observation, meaning you can't use the scientific method to discover when the kingdom arrives. You can't just, you know, watch the patterns in the sky or turn on the news. You can't hunt for or guess its timing. It is not that the kingdom has no observable realities, but it is true that the scientific method will never figure out its timing. His proof of this is his second reason. He says, you want to know why I know this is? You want to know why I want to tell you that you can't see the kingdom or know the kingdom by observable signs? He says, because the kingdom is already in your midst, and you missed it. The proof that you can't prove the kingdom's timing by what you think are observable signs is the fact that I, the King of the kingdom, am right here in the middle of you, and you have completely overlooked it and missed every sign that God has given you, signs that would require faith. The kingdom for Jesus is already here precisely because he is here. I mean, if you look at the Old Testament and you discover that the kingdom is God's ruling through God's man, in particular a king, over God's people in God's place, Jesus says, that's me and that's happening right now. I am the very rule and power of God in your midst, in human flesh. I am God's people in human flesh. I am the obedient Israelite. I'm everything that you were intended to be. And here I am also where God intends for his people to meet. I am the temple. I am the now, the only and sole mediator between God and man. Everything that you're waiting for, a place to worship God according to God's rule and reign in the midst of a people who are under God's authority, that's taking place right now in me and anyone who joins with me during this time of my ministry. The kingdom cannot come with observation because it will never meet your preconceived expectations. It will require faith and not sight. It will require the spiritual sight that one Samaritan had when he came back to give thanks, and the nine others did not have when they never came back to return. Your very asking of the question, then, Jesus says to the Pharisees, is a sign of your blindness to the revelation of God, because the kingdom is present right now and you can't see it. So in case you missed it, in case you missed some reasons to be offended, I will make it abundantly clear. Jesus is saying in this text and throughout the Gospels that the long-awaited Davidic rule of God, that millennial reign, that time where Israel would be established through a king over the nations and so forth, has already started. It started when Jesus came. And that is not a hidden reality in the New Testament. It is repeated over and over and over. It's almost as if you have to want to miss it. You don't have to wait for the kingdom, because the kingdom is already here. And it's true right now. I mean, whether you feel like it's true or not does not cease to make it so. There is a reason, for example, that the very first sermon preached in the New Testament after people are caught speaking tongues in the book of Acts, Peter says, this is exactly what the prophet Joel told us would happen. And then what does he say? In the last days, my spirit will be poured out on all flesh. The very first thing Peter says is, the last days have arrived. You should be able to see it. How should you be able to see it? Well, look at the Spirit's been poured out on all flesh. Over and over in the New Testament, we are told the timing of God's kingdom, or the end times of God's kingdom, have arrived in Jesus' life and his death and his resurrection. And therefore, there is no need to look for signs. One, because the kingdom doesn't look anything like you would think it would look like, so whatever signs you look for will be wrong-headed. But two, because it's already here, and it's present in the world as we speak. So they are to stop looking for the signs of the times, but they're also to stop looking for things to get easier. So Jesus says, first, the kingdom's already here, and it would seem like this next thing he says doesn't fit at all with the first thing that he says. If Jesus is here and God's kingdom is here, you would think, well, then good. The good times will also be here. And Jesus says, let me just disabuse you of that notion as well, right off the bat. He wants his disciples to know, as paradoxical as it may seem, that just because the kingdom is here, it doesn't mean things will get any easier for them, or that trials will cease, or that suffering will be put to an end. In fact, he says it's quite the contrary. He says the days are coming in our text this morning where you are going to long for the days of the Son of Man. You're just going to long for the day when I was with you. And you're going to hear some people say, hey, the Son of Man, he's over here, you know, in this desert. Or oh, he's over here, you know, in this particular place. And you will be so worn out by your trials and so desperate to see me and so wanting the kingdom to be established that you'll go out and be deceived by these deceivers, and at times deceive others. But he says, don't fall for it. It's because when that final day of the Son of Man comes, you won't have to look for it or you won't have to guess that it arrived. He says, you don't uproot your life and go. Don't waste any gas to go get there, to think that you've discovered where I might have returned, because everyone will see it. It'll be like lightning in the midst of a night sky. You won't have to guess whether it took place or not. It will light upon everyone. It will be universal. It will be sudden. And it will not be hidden. It will not be like the first coming of our Lord. And you will not need a specially trained eye to see it. For even the one not seeking any signs will be blinded by its reality. So we see in this text two very specific time periods being mentioned. We see the days of the Son of Man, and then we see the day of the Son of Man. And both of those encapsulate what we would call the kingdom of God. And here's what he means. Jesus already told us the kingdom is here. And with his coming, every day after that are the days of the Son of Man. You're living in those days right now. You're living in the end times. But so were your parents and your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and everybody since the coming of Christ. The end times began way back then. But he also tells us there is a final day. A day that ends all days as we know them. A day that brings the kingdom in all of its visible glory, a day that wraps up the whole story to where we are no longer beholding the kingdom by faith, but we are seeing it by sight, where righteousness reigns in the world fully and finally. And that day, again, he says, is visible, not confusing, not hidden, universally witnessed. It is the last day of the last days, if you will. But until then, you'll notice he's warning his disciples, it's not going to get any easier. As you live through these days of the Son of Man, you are going to suffer. And why do I say that he says that? You'll notice he told them first, you'll be longing for a time when you saw me. There's going to come a period of time during these days of the Son of Man you are going to wish for this time when I was in your midst. Or you're really going to be longing for that time when I come to establish everything. And he says, in fact, the only temporal marker I'm going to tell you, the only thing that has to happen before that final day is I have to suffer and be rejected by this generation. Right after he tells them, the kingdom's here because I'm in your midst, he then tells them, and I'm going to be rejected by the whole nation and suffer at the hands of this generation, which would have been a very difficult thought for them to get their minds around as they read their Old Testament. He will then tell them that in order to save their lives, they must lose them. It is not a rah-rah, cheerleading sort of message here that he's giving. He's saying, hey, the kingdom has come, and then he starts to list out all the suffering they're going to endure now that they're in the kingdom, and they're here with this particular king. And that teaches us something. It teaches us that the kingdom is present, but it's not present in its final form. We are members of it by faith at present. Christ is ruling and reigning over all the nations at present, right? The Bible tells us that. As soon as he rises from the dead, he says, all authority in heaven and earth will be given to me someday way in the future when I set up my kingdom. No, he says, it's all been given to me now. The nations are mine, which is why in the book of Acts, all of a sudden we see God's kingdom going from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria to the uttermost parts of the world. Christ is claiming the world for himself because he owns the world. It's his. He's the king of all kings and the Lord of all lords. And anyone who has faith knows that, but that's the problem with the present age, right? It has to be believed by faith. And we are waiting for the day when everything that we believe by faith is visible to all of those who presently reject and mock the concept. From now until then, trials and suffering are real. And not only real, to be expected. I mean, we shouldn't be shocked or surprised if this life presents difficulties to us, or if the church undergoes trial and tribulation or persecution. And any form of Christianity that teaches otherwise should be rejected out of hand. It is a farce and a fraud. It has nothing to do with the Christ of the New Testament. If the king of the kingdom suffered during these days, even unto death, we should not be shocked that his body on earth will also suffer until he comes again. And in fact, he tells us as much. In fact, he tells us the kingdom will not make our lives easier, but harder. That once you join, you really join, in one sense, a burden. And I don't mean that to talk you out of it, but it's the realities of the case, right? You take up your cross and you follow him. Can you imagine, what the disciples had to reckon with because of this? They're hearing this, and they believe it to a degree, but can you imagine their view of the kingdom when forced to watch the crucifixion from a distance? When all of their hopes in the Messiah are presently hanging before them, gasping for life on the cross. And they have to look at one another and say, "This is the King of Kings who's come to bring salvation to the world." "Behold your king," is what Pontius Pilate cried, and that was exactly what they were to do, to behold him as he truly was. A king here who is dead and risen and then removed, and these disciples are now left on earth to do his bidding. How difficult that must have been, especially as they go out with his message and they do not find, while they do find some success for sure, they also find with that success an inordinate amount of persecution, rejection, and danger. And they find a whole world looking at them as foolish. And this kingdom that is based on a cross becomes our life until it gives way to a kingdom that will visibly grant to us a crown. But the way from here to there is a cross-bearing way. And Christ doesn't want them to be fooled. And a kingdom, of course, that promises that, that promises suffering, is really difficult to advertise. Right? You don't put that on the church billboard unless you are really trying to dwindle down the numbers. But when you also think about it, this has been true for 2,000 years now. Just like Peter said, there will be many who will come and keep saying, where is the promise of his coming? You guys have been talking about this story for years as the church. Christ is never going to establish his kingdom. It was just a fairy tale. You see, a kingdom that seems far away to sufferers, if you're going through trials and the kingdom is not coming, that poses a threat, and that's the final warning that he gives, which is to stop looking for a kingdom without a king. While the calamity of the final day, he says, will separate everyone, the true separation actually takes place in the mundane realities of life. They're made visible on that final day when one is taken and another left behind, and one is judged and another is set free. But the reality is those separations are made right now in the midst of the boring and the mundane and the tedious. And it all comes down, of course, to a disposition toward the king. That long period of the end times from Jesus until now is filled with lots of 24-hour days without much festivity or frills. And that is where the danger, as well as salvation, lie. And we see that in the examples given. You notice he talks about Noah, Lot, and then this lady, loosely called. We're told to remember the days of Noah and Lot. And while those of us who have some biblical knowledge, we hear Noah and Lot, and then we start to think about the generations in which they live, and we think about all of the evil of the people that were around them. Sodom and Gomorrah, obviously, as the preeminent example of immorality. But that's not why Jesus is using this example. He doesn't say, remember Noah and Lot, they lived in really evil times. He says, remember them because you know what was going on in their day? Just the same old thing. People were getting up for work in the morning, driving on the freeway, having their cup of coffee, eating lunch, coming home, turning on the news, having their beer after dinner, going to sleep, starting it all over again. And then out of nowhere, a separation came. There was no warning. It was just normal life. Things were always going to go on like they had always gone on. And then this day of judgment came without any kind of indicator. It separated everyone. The rebuke is not, again, the immorality of the two times, but the utter consumption and absorption of the people into their mundane life without any thought of a danger that could be present or of a kingdom that could be coming. They felt no threat, and therefore they felt no need to consider the eternal, what would happen after this place and these times. Their daily life had completely snuffed out the concept of the next life. I mean, face it, urgency is hard to feel when thousands, literally thousands of years have gone by with no catastrophic judgment falling on humanity. I mean, isn't it hard to feel a threat when that's the case? Notice it says the danger is that the stuff of life, the good stuff of life that God gives to us, the good things, can become deadly diversions, a stumbling block, if it so dulls our minds that it eclipses any orientation for us toward the life to come. That if those things just become life itself, he says, that is the danger. People get lulled to sleep all the time. Look at Noah's day and Lot's day. There was no need for them to heed a threat because nothing had ever happened before. And who is to think something would happen now? And I've got work to do and food to eat and places to be. Notice Luke actually uses good images, desirous things, as the things that blind us. I mean, think of it. A gospel that is all about, Luke's gospel, that's all about sitting down at table with Jesus and with the weak and the wounded to eat and to drink. You will not find a gospel in this Bible that has Jesus eating and drinking more than this gospel. Not only doing so, saying, the best thing you can do is stop what you're doing and just come and enjoy the feast with me. In fact, the reward that I will give will be a feast. And then Luke at the same time says, yeah, they were eating and drinking and they all died. He says the same table that is our offer, a table that says come and eat and drink with the king, can become a table of death when instead of being a blessing that points us toward glory and enlarges in us a longing for the world to come, it becomes the whole world. It becomes all that there is. You know, every good gift that God gives is a revelation of Himself. Every single one. You know, part of why you should pray before your meals is not so you don't get judged by the guy sitting next to you who's a Christian. It's a reminder that these are good gifts, right? We all know they're good. Every non-believer goes to restaurants and loves them for the most part. Everyone knows they're good, but not everyone knows that they're gifts. Not everyone knows that they come from someone. And if they're gifts and if they're that good, then the giver himself must be good. And it's just a small token before we eat that we say, these good things that I'm going to enjoy as good are given by someone who's even better than the thing. When instead of loving God more through our bellies, our God becomes our belly, we are in danger of what Luke's talking about here. And of course, it's not just food. It's anything and everything that is good and worthwhile. As we've said before, when good things become the main thing or the ultimate thing, they become deadly things. Every good thing in life is handed down from God. And every good thing handed down from God can become deadly when it becomes our God. Notice we see this with Lot's wife so clearly. What's the issue? The fire came. She had seconds to depart. And instead of saying, well, all that stuff pales in comparison to the salvation that's being given, she turned back and was like, if I could just grab the KitchenAid. Or, you know, I just had remodeled the living room. You know, this everything I love and own is there. And because she couldn't escape the pull of the place, she became a permanent fixture in the place. She became, in one sense, what she loved. She looked back and said, but what about my life? Which is why Jesus says, if you're not ready to lose your life, you're going to lose it. But if you're willing to lose life, what you think is life, for my sake, then you'll find it. You'll be given back this life, but you'll also gain the life to come. And that is why this gift of life, which is so wonderful, can become in the wrong hands so deadly. Because through it and through our love for it, we can lose the King. I mean, that is the final stop it that Jesus gives. Stop looking for a kingdom without or apart from the King. Augustine, mourning his late in life conversion, says this: late have I loved you. O beauty ever ancient, ever new, late have I loved you. You were within me, but I was outside myself. And it was there that I searched for you. In my unloveliness, I plunged into the lovely things which you created. You were with me, but I was not with you. Created things kept me from you. Yet if they had not been in you, they would have not been at all. See, a warning to the kingdom resident, those of us who sit in Christ's church this morning as his people, is to not get lost in the mundane. From the now of the kingdom present till the then of the kingdom visible, there are just lots of days. I mean, some of you have already lived lots of those days. And you know how tiring, in one sense, this life can be, and how much of a struggle it can be, and how many temptations arise in the midst of it. So many days that final day will appear not to be a thing at all. It will seem like a false promise and a false hope, and the world will never seem like that. It pays early anyway. It will seem full of promise. As Bright Eyes so poignantly wrote, even in their unbelief, is it true what I heard about the Son of God? Did he come to save? Did he come at all? And if I dried his feet with my dirty hair, would he make me clean again? You know, they say, they don't know when, but a day is going to come when there won't be a moon and there won't be a sun. It will just all go black. It will all go back to the way it was before. And he finishes the song with these words: is it true what I heard about the Son of God? Did he die for us? Did he die at all? And if I sold my soul for a bag of gold, which one of us would be the fool? See, the only thing that can conquer love for this world and those who would say, why not cash in on the promise that is right here in front of you? All the shiny things, all the good things. The only thing that can keep you from clinging to that and losing your hope for eternity is to start loving the King. I mean, think about what eternal life is, and I think this is part of our problem. Eternal life is about receiving Christ and his kingdom. The idea that it's just about escaping wrath is not enough. It will never be enough. You will never love God just to stay out of trouble. You know, that may heighten your awareness of why you need to think about God, but just escaping hell or staying out of trouble is never going to be enough to make Christ lovely to you. Notice Lot's wife looked back because she longed for something. She found something lovely and lovable. And our longing should be pointed forward instead of backward. When the kingdom comes, it should be like summer's arrival, not summer's end. We shouldn't go dragging our feet, well, like now all the fun's over. Christ's kingdom's here. We have to clean up our act. It should be like stepping into a long-awaited dream. So think about that. If the fire's coming, what is your prized possession? Is it what's inside your house? Or is it what's outside? the Christ who is arriving? Is that what you've been waiting for? Is that what you're longing for? Or is it second fiddle to all these other things you've accumulated? I mean, looking back the day Christ arrives would be ridiculous if he is our beloved, if he's the one that we love above all else. As one reformer wrote, true love is mostly delighted with the presence of the beloved and is tormented, as it were, by the absence of the same. I mean, it will be Christ in all of his beauty that will make the things of this earth grow dim in our minds at that final trumpet. All of this will be we'll say, thank God it's over, and step into the glory of glory, as opposed to looking back and thinking we've lost something. And of course, love for this place and love for its stuff is a threat, and the only thing to undo that threat is written right within this text. There's two things that Christ gives us to make him all the more lovely. He gives us suffering as like a pry bar for this age, to remind us it's always a drag. That new car you waited for, it already has a ding in it. You know, the relationship that you couldn't live without, 30 years in, it's still worthwhile, but it's not easy, right? All of these things in this life that you find, the health that you worked so hard to maintain, it's going to break down. Everything in this life ends, and it ends poorly. And Christ uses suffering as a way to say, don't bother getting attached here. Don't love this stuff that much. It never pays fully what it promises. But he also, of course, gives us not just suffering as a pry bar, but the cross as a persuasion. Right in the midst of this text is a Christ who says, I am the long-awaited Davidic king. I'm God in human flesh. And I love you so much that I am going to suffer and be rejected by this generation to give you life and life abundantly. And he comes to you week in and week out in the preaching of the word and in his body and blood and bread and wine to say, find me lovely because I have loved you. Is it true what they say about the Son of God? Did he die for us? Did he die at all? The answer to that question is yes. And because he first loved us in this way, we should love him all the more. May that happen to us this morning, even as we partake of his goodness in this service. Let us pray.